Now then, we need to go over some ground rules.
Okay.
You are to refrain from any acts of violence, including verbal assault and vulgar hand gestures. You may not use rage-enhancing substances, such as caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, crack cocaine, slippy flippies, jelly stingers, trick sticks, bing-bangs, or flying willards.
How about fiddle-faddles?
Under my supervision. Also, if you're unable to stop masturbating, please do so without the use of any pornographic images depicting quote-unquote angry sex. That having been said, I'm a pretty good guy, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised how much fun we can have together.
Jeez, without slippy flippies or angry masturbating, I don't see how that's possible.
Sarcasm is anger's ugly cousin. From now on, unacceptable. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm one of your curators on this exploration into the shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler, Devin Decker. And joining me, as always, as we gallivant around the galaxy that is the filmography of Mr. Adam Sandler, one Sejan Serowik. Sejan?
Thank you, Devin. And today we are truly going to go somewhere in this galaxy we've never gone before, and that's into the puzzle of the human mind.
Oh,
this is,
wow.
This is definitely... Oh, did I lose you already?
No, it was the... We don't prepare, folks. I need you to know that, which is good that we don't prepare, because what's about to
that's
happen...
No, that's... Wait a minute. We're not gonna act like this is some, you know... I just made you crack it like three lines. I've never done that before.
No, I thought that I thought that you broke the character in the human mind bit. You were still like a fricket. I corpse, ladies and gentlemen, here today on International Women's Day. I corpsed. Hi, welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. You know what it is? I got a lot going on in my mind right now, because right now we're here. We are in the third episode of season 5. It is our reboot, remakes, redo season. And Sejan, I should have checked with you beforehand, but I'm redoing the show a little bit right now. On the fly, doing it live. I need to adjust something about the show, because... Okay. What you need to know about me and anger management, and there's so many other things that you need to understand. If you're someone who's here from our Longest Yard episode, welcome back. I promise you we will pass judgment on Longest Yard and whether or not it has a place in our shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films. It's going to happen. But the first thing that I have to say about anger management before anything is that I hate this movie. I hate this movie with a raw, burning intensity. And because of that, here's a little bit of a disclaimer before we start the episode proper. If you are a person out there who has not seen 2003's Anger Management, starring Adam Sandler and Jack Nicholson, directed by Peter Siegel, and you have any desire to see this movie, even just the smallest little sliver of desire, it's a splinter in your little pinky toe that says, I want to check out that movie someday. I have to insist, absolutely insist, that you stop our podcast right now. I know that's not a great way to retain an audience. Siege and I apologize. But here's the thing that's going to happen at the 5-minute mark. You have until the 5-minute mark. This show has a very rigid structure. Sejan and I, before we decided to do the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe episodes proper, we sat down and we designed a beautifully rigid structure. And the second part of that structure, the second thing that has happened in the 28 episodes prior to this one, is that I read a synopsis of the film that I prepared myself. And right now, in the anger management episode, we're flipping that script because I'm starting with the synopsis. And I'm going to be honest with you, there be spoilers ahead. And I'm talking like by the third sentence of the synopsis. And I don't want to ruin this movie for you if somehow you've never seen it, but still have a sliver of desire to. Are you all right with that, Siegen?
We do. I am going to take umbrage with only one thing, but I need to hear your synopsis before I take umbrage with it. But I think I'm going to take umbrage with one part of this entire process. But at that point, let's do this.
Okay. I'm going to give you till 5:30 now. That's how kind I am as a podcaster. So you have 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Dave Busnick is a 35-year-old executive assistant who has things going pretty all right in his life. He's dating a beautiful poetry teacher named Linda, and with all the extra work he's been putting in for his boss Frank Head on the new Husky Cat clothing line, he's a shoo-in for that open creative executive position at work. Unfortunately, Dave lives in 2003, when toxic masculinity was a highly valued trait, so all of that is about to change. Linda read the book Nobody Cares, inspiring her to hire its author, Dr. Buddy Rydell, to make Dave more assertive. But in the end, what that boils down to is hiring a stranger to gaslight her boyfriend into thinking he has anger issues while also systematically destroying every aspect of his life. Buddy kicks off his plan by arranging to be on Dave's flight for a work event in St. Louis. He also arranges for someone to take Dave's assigned seat so they'll be seated next to each other. Then, Buddy begins acting annoyingly aggressive towards Dave, who, in order to sate his actions, agrees to watch the in-flight movie. Politely asking the flight attendant for a headset, when she proceeds to ignore his request, Dave gently taps her arm to get her attention, prompting her to accuse him of assault. This, catching the attention of an air marshal, causes him to tase Dave and have the plane rerouted back to New York. Once back in the city, Dave is sentenced to 20 hours of anger management therapy. When Dave arrives at the group, he is surprised to learn the therapist is his abusive seatmate from the flight. Since he was there to witness what actually happened, Dave tries to convince Buddy to just sign off on his 20 hours. Buddy insists Dave attend at least one meeting before he will sign, and then proceeds to treat Dave with hostility during the proceedings. This results in Buddy assigning Dave an anger ally to help him cope with any anger episodes, while Dave helps them with coping in return. Later that night, Dave's anger ally shows up at his apartment in the early stages of an episode, and the two wind up in a bar fight. Despite only acting in self-defense, because it is his second offense, the judge sentences Dave to a year in jail. Buddy conveniently arrives and instead convinces the judge Dave should be enrolled in his 30-day intensive anger management program. This requires Buddy move into Dave's apartment and further turn his life upside down, which eventually culminates in Buddy stealing Linda from him. Luckily for Dave, losing his girlfriend is just the motivation he needs to finally become the toxically assertive specimen celebrated at the time, leading Dave to declare his love for Linda and ask him to marry him at Yankee Stadium. After she has accepted his proposal, Linda admits what she has done, and Dave is just fine with it, and they assumingly live happily ever after. Hi.
Hi, man. Your anger fueled you.
It really did. I don't know if that was more explosive anger or implosive anger. I wasn't kidding, ladies, gentlemen, dogs, cats, Alexas that somehow had this activated and then had their owner walk out of the room. I hated this movie. And mostly I hated the movie because of the gaslighting. is so central to its plot.
Yeah. So where do we start on this? So let's talk about first, let's talk about impressions watching this movie. I get the impression this was your first time, first of all.
Yeah. Yes. So here's what I'm going to say. What we're doing in this season to try to get things back on track, unflip the script, even though, hi, that's the synopsis within the first 10 minutes. I don't think that will ever happen again. This movie I watched the Thursday after we recorded The Longest Yard. And the reason for that is because we are smack dab in the middle of our season doing reboots, remakes, and redos. And this one is a little bit different. Anger management is one of the only Adam Sandler projects that then went on to have an American English language reboot remake done from it, which is the 2012 anger management sitcom on FX starring Charlie Sheen. So I wanted to make sure that I watched the movie as early as possible so that I could delve into the 100 episodes of anger management that exist.
That weird 72 episode second season there, right there.
90. It's 90 episode second season.
So they like split them like six more episodes off into a season three, quote unquote. But I get the impression they didn't air that way. Like I get like from what I understand, they aired in a row, but they did that thing in like retro, you know, they retroactively broke certain episodes off into seasons.
Yeah.
So there's technically like four seasons of that show, even though there was like actually two, and one just went on for a year and a half.
On Amazon, where I have currently purchased three seasons, I was unable to get through all 100 episodes, though I have watched the highest rated episode on IMDb. So, I mean, I feel like I did a pretty good thing. I got through 34 episodes. No, I got through, I want to say 40 episodes of this series, because it's 10 in the first, and then I watched all of season two, which is another 22. So that right there is 32. And then I got through, eight more episodes. So I've watched 40 episodes of the anger management TV show.
Nice.
And the reason for that is I asked my family if they wanted to go on the anger management journey with me. And despite my mother and father being like, that movie with Nicholson, that movie sucks, they both said, yeah, let's watch the Charlie Sheen show together. So I've been watching it with my family, and I gotta say, in my opinion, in Devin Decker's opinion, I am not speaking for Seijin, it is the best thing to come from the 2003 anger management film.
Nine years
later, Charlie Sheen used anger management as a platform to try to get his life back on track.
You know, the best thing about this dog shit is it's not quite nearly as bad as that dog shit.
I mean, actually, here's the big thing about it. This dog shit, the movie, what we are here to truly discuss in this episode, is so mean. It is one of the meanest things that I can remember watching in a really long time. And it, by comparison, the Charlie Sheen show is hyper kind and supportive. And there are consequences for their actions. It's literally night and day.
It's edgy. It's edgy, but it's not mean. This movie is. Yeah. So this, just to kind of just my viewing of anger management this time for this episode, I have seen this movie multiple times in my life, and we'll talk about that later. But this viewing of this episode for this episode triggered the early stages of a panic attack for me when I got to the I remembered what the twist was at the end of this movie. It's kind of hard to ever forget it after you see it the first time, right? You just start picking up on shit, you know, in your second viewings once you realize what's going on, and it just led to some really 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 bad paranoia thoughts, and all of a sudden I was like, I need to walk away from this movie for like just like 20 minutes just to like get a glass of water, go look at the mountains, and then I came back inside and finished it. But this movie is just terrifying.
it is. Right, here's the most terrifying thing about it, right? And here's first impressions, right? So watching it on February 9th, 2023, right after we had recorded The Longest Yard, which by all accounts really surprised me by just how faithful a remake it was and just how enjoyable a film it was. To the fact that, like, famously at this point, we did not know how to judge the film, if it should be part of the Adam Sandler thing or if we were just being blinded by how enjoyable a film it actually is.
Yeah.
I sit down with anger management, and this is some like real origin of Devin type stuff. It triggered for me the memory of the time that I was sentenced to anger management therapy because of a situation at my office in 2014. No, summer 2015, sorry, where I was in complete control, but it just felt like everybody was acting against me. That level of paranoia that it inspired in you is a level of paranoia that I have experienced in my actual life that culminated in me being sentenced to 3 sessions of anger management therapy with a licensed therapist. And, you know, happy ending for this whole situation. That therapist sat down with me within 2 minutes, said, "You clearly don't have anger issues. This was a really bad day where kind of everybody was piling up on you. Had you not reacted the way that you did?" And the way that I reacted was to say, "I need to go home." And I just left the office that day and used personal time, which I completely had as part of my job. And it was one of those situations where I did not yell. I did not, like, scream at anybody. I just said, "This is getting out of hand and I'm going to remove myself from the situation." And they took that to mean that I was so angry I needed to see a therapist. And he said...
Yeah, well, so what you're pointing to, right, and this movie is completely, like, awash in this shit, is this complete lack of understanding that, I mean, we still have to this day, but we definitely had in droves back then, of mental health, right?
Yeah.
And the idea of, like, taking a quote-unquote mental health day, like saying, "I need to leave right now because I'm in a situation that is dangerous for my emotional mental health, like, I need to be out of here." Like, and the fact that that is still... questioned and misunderstood on some level, you know, because like if you had like slammed your hand in a drawer and it was like turning purple and you said, "I need to get out of here," nobody would have thought a thing, right? Your bad day just happened to come into a bunch of mental triggers, and that shit has just completely just mystified people for so long. And this movie, it just makes fun of it. Like, there's no way to talk about this gracefully, right? Like, they just, right? And it's like, oh no, they're finally making fun of something that, like, offends us, so now we're finally offended. I get it. There's always been offensive, like, stuff going on in these movies. But this isn't just offensive. This is, like, dangerous. And that's kind of the line that we talk about all the time, is at what point does the comedy ever cross that? And it's always been moments in movies. This time it's the whole movie.
Yeah, there's not one moment in this movie where I'm like, oh, they're handling the understanding of mental health and seeking help from a licensed therapist in this positive way. They're removing stigma. I mean, by Peter Siegel's own admissions, he said that his desire was to make the viewer feel off kilter, feel uncomfortable, and constantly be questioning whether or not Jack Nicholson's character was an actual therapist or just a lunatic that Adam Sandler had somehow wound up in the orbit of. And it's like, what the hell is that? That just seems like a way to make a bad movie.
Well, in a lot of ways, it feels almost like, as you're describing that, I could close my eyes and see just a sliver of What About Bob with Bill Murray, right? And we've talked about that movie before, where there's definitely a lot of issues because of the ways that movie handles mental health and all of that. But at the time, was at least considered an enjoyable enough film that people like still talk. I mean, we knew people that had the poster for it up on their wall in college.
Yes.
That kind of shit, right? Like, right. So is it just a time difference? Because that movie comes out, what, at the end of the 80s, early 90s, right?
If, yeah, I remember, like, correctly. 90, I believe,
and then this is 10, 15 years later, right? Is it just in a matter of time, we just don't want that kind of comedy anymore? Or is there something that movie does that we are okay with that allows that kind of dark exploration and dark humor exploration of this kind of world, right? Just final thought, like, there are other movies out there that delve into this kind of humor, right? Like, and they succeed. Why do they succeed and this one doesn't is, like, I couldn't even begin to tell you, right? Like, we'd have to watch all of them first to figure it out.
Specifically with something like What About Bob, and this is not going to become the What About Bob cinematic universe podcast,
which was, but, I mean, like, not everybody loves that movie either. I'm not going to sit here and act like,
exactly,
it's the pinnacle of filmmaking,
but
in this particular genre
3.
Of film,
yes,
no, but in this particular genre of film, it is definitely one of the more successful ones you could point to.
But I guess the demarcation line for me and why something like What About Bob works is because the line is very clearly drawn in the sand between who the doctor is and who the patient is. And the, mm-hmm. it's Richard, it's not Gear, it's Dreyfuss. Richard Dreyfuss is very clearly a well-known, respected psychiatrist, psychologist. That is never really in question. And Bill Murray very clearly has some mental issues, though it does seem like it's hypochondria and everything kind of spirals out from that. Again, we're not here. I haven't seen that movie in about 10 years, but by clearly delineating who is the white spy and who is the black spy, right?
Yeah, the movie doesn't lie to you, yeah. right? And like that's what this movie does.
This movie just outright lies to you.
Yeah. And then wants you to laugh along with it at the end, right? It's just like, it's weird. It's a weird concept to make a yeah. movie on. And what I can't believe is that this is what leads to them then making 50 First Dates, the longest yard.
Right, that this started beautiful friendship between them. I mean, the reason it does, and I don't want to ape on it, maybe you want to get into facts and figures, but I think the facts and figures have a lot to do with the continued collaborations between Adam Sandler and Peter Siegel.
So this movie comes out in April of 2003. So this is kind of right in the midpoint of we kind of refer to this area of Sandler's career as kind of like the hump, right? Where he's kind of already, he's done Little Nicky, I think, at this point, right? Was that 2000?
Little Nicky is 2000.
And so he's kind of getting his hits, like critics are definitely starting to tear into him, but he's still making bank on every movie. So he's kind of in that weird area where he's super successful, but now like people are starting to question why he keeps being so successful. And this movie is no different. It is a $75 million film. I imagine most of that budget goes to just getting Jack Nicholson on set, right? Like $75 million in this movie. I guess the Yankee Stadium scenes at the end, right?
Oh my god, that Yankee Stadium. There is a whole documentary about the fact that they only had 3,500 extras. And the rest of it's all computer generated. Like they would move those 3,500 people around as they needed them, but then the rest of it is all wireframes and computer generated crowds.
Just like Tony Hawk crowds back there. Just some guy with two frames of motion, hot dog in mouth, hot dog out, hot dog in, hot dog out.
I mean, I will say this, part of the vast rabbit holes that I went down on this was watching some of the special features, and we'll get to why later on. I don't want to blow up that bridge right now, but it is watching these documentaries that are out there about the making of this film. That Yankee Stadium scene also probably where a lot of the $75 million went to, but then it's a 50,000 seat house. So with 3,500 people, think of how many people they had to create with computers. That's like Lord of the Rings level.
Well, funny enough, they just use the same assets.
Yeah, there's a bunch of orcs rooting for the other team. That
just all the Bostonians, all the Boston Red Sox guys. Oh, shit. Yeah, so it's a $75 million movie, and it ends up, by the time you count international, like, it's a $200 million success. So, like, it pulls in more than twice what it cost to make. So why wouldn't they keep working together? Panned, though. Like just hugely panned. And like, again, even by audiences at this point. Like, the bounce, it doesn't do much better than Little Nicky in either regard. Little Nicky was a 21-55 critics to audience. What do you think Anger Management got?
I would imagine that Anger Management's a little bit higher. I would go 31-67.
Okay, a little low on the first, a little high on the other, so it evens out to about the same. It's basically 40-60.
Okay.
So, yeah,
that's how many Anger Management episodes I watched and how many I have left. Ta-da!
The stars are all aligning for you. Man, so yeah, this is just a wild. Did you talk about the fact that John C. Reilly is?
Oh no, I didn't talk about. Do you want me to? Well, here's the thing. I can leap into that off of the other thing I wanted to say.
I don't just mean the fact that John C. Reilly's in this movie, but the character he plays, right? Because that's just a whole other.
That's a whole other kettle of fish. It is. So sorry. Panna Kamanana, or Peanuts, if you're Jack Nicholson, is the character that he plays. The big thing about this film in terms of money is that this is the first time that a Jack Nicholson film breaks $100 million since As Good As It Gets in 1997. As Good As It Gets nominated for Best Picture. I believe Helen Hunt won for Best Supporting Actress in that one. If not, I know that there were nominations up and down, like Greg Kinnear nominated. Yeah. And like that, and the only reason that I bring up, I assure you, if I can find enough ether, I will convince Sejan to do an episode of As Good As It Gets for the Say Report for the 30th anniversary. But where the story that I can tell now is a bunch of eighth graders go to the movie theater to go see Titanic. It is sold out. And Devin Decker convinces this group of people to go see As Good As It Gets instead. And I'm the only one who's like excited to see it. And it's me and a bunch of like the basketball guys, because like a basketball player lived across the street from me, and either best friends with that guy or mortal enemies. And we were still in the best friend like portion of our lives. So it was him, the girl he was seeing, and a bunch of other jock type people and their girlfriends, and then Devin Decker, who convinces them, yeah, let's go see As Good As It Gets, right? Like, it's getting the same type of talk as Titanic. And I enjoyed it, and two of the girls, one of whom still communicates with me on Facebook, enjoyed it. So, like, interesting memory there. But think about that. That's 97, so it is 6 years since Jack Nicholson has seen himself in a hit. And so that's just crazy, too. And I think the fact that I'm talking about Jack Nicholson might be betraying some thoughts I'm going to have later on in the episode. But it is definitely something that sticks out to me. And then going forward to John C. Reilly, John C. Reilly appears in this movie completely uncredited. They did not, even though he's in the trailer, which is nuts to me, the man is uncredited. And he is fresh off of appearing in two films that were nominated for Best Picture in 2002, one of which actually wins, you know, that Chicago. And then he's also in The Hours. Right. And he himself.
I forgot he was in The Hours, yes.
And he's freaking Julianne Moore's husband. I tell you, Sejan, I went down some holes for this episode. And he himself was nominated for Best Supporting Actor alongside Christopher Walken, Paul Newman, Ed Harris, and Chris Cooper, who ultimately won for his appearance in Adaptation. So, like, it's not John C. Reilly just, like, we picked this guy up because he's, like, kind of known in Hollywood.
He didn't just fall off of the Will Ferrell bus and roll into the Adam Sandler room, right?
If anything, this is what gets him picked up onto the Will Ferrell bus. Is something like his time as Pana Kamanana in Anger Management. Arnie Shankman, that was his original name.
Oh, man.
Also,
this is so wild. Like, the weird twists and turns that this movie makes just to get to, like, a bit. And, like, and then to find out the entire time that you're just, like, getting, you know, lied to the entire time. It's just, there's never a... It feels like watching Jackass and you were the one they were pulling the pranks on the entire time.
See, have you checked the back of your head? Because I'm pretty sure you've been shaved, my friend. That's how Steve-O gets into your house. Put on Anger Management and then Steve-O creeps in through the shadows and shaves the back of your head.
And then he gives you a pep talk about how you could be doing better in life.
And he tattoos your face on your back. It depends on how into Anger Management you are.
And then runs out off into the night. He's on to the next test.
On to the next viewer of Anger Management. Yeah. So, my first impression, and the other thing about the first impression, right, as much as, like, it triggered my own memories of how me thinking that I had acted in all of the proper ways in this situation ended up with me in front of a therapist saying, well, you clearly don't have anger issues. I don't want to waste our time with two more sessions. And him being told by my union representation that if he wouldn't see me for two more sessions, I would be fired. So then it turning into me going into his office to hand him a check for the session and then walk out. Like, that's how it had to happen. That's just, like, the craziest thing in the world to me. Because he's like, you don't have it. You reacted the right way. I'm sorry that happened to you, Devin. I can't do
Yeah, well,
anything
imagine
more.
if a mental health professional had been involved in the process anywhere else along the way, right?
Yeah,
Like, that's.
exactly. Just,
Yeah, it's. A, but,
yeah,
in,
exactly.
and
But
that's
that,
the.
but that,
That's
but.
the, just like. That is what is just so crazy about this movie, right? Is because they never. Do they clear. They don't clarify everything as being a joke, right? Like, just like. The, so.
The only stuff that they confirm, that they absolutely confirm, is that Jack Nicholson put himself on the plane, that he knew the stewardess, and that he knows, rest in peace, this episode is also dedicated to her memory. Lynn Thigpen's judge character
Yeah.
is also in on it. That
She is.
yeah.
So there's this like this just horrible miscarriage of justice going on here to lie to this person.
And a waste of like time and funds. I originally had it in there, but I had to cut it for time. He's charged $3,500. He's charged a $3,500 fine. Is that to pay Buddy? Does that money like actually go somewhere? Is he expected to pay that money? Sijin, I don't want to like sound alarmist when I say this. If I were sentenced to give somebody $3,500 right now, I would be in financial ruin.
I mean, yeah, right. That's the. I mean, you're not the only one, man. That's like a common thing nowadays of like, if your car broke down, how fucked would you be, right? Like, yeah.
It's.
But the. So the judge is on it, but then you start to question how much else is in on it, right? There's so much going on in this movie, and I have to say, I don't understand at any point what kind of anger issues he supposedly has.
He doesn't have anger issues.
Like
It is.
it's the craziest thing ever is like I don't I it, they just take a they take a good man and they break him. Like on top of everything, like he's just a normal guy and they turn him into a fucking asshole at the end.
I mean, look at my synopsis. Everything is going pretty all right in his life. He's dealing with the stuff that kind of everybody is dealing with. A boss who's kind of a jerk, but you're doing your job because, hello, it's your job. And it turns out it's pretty expensive to live, right? Like, he needs money to pay his rent, to buy food, and all of these other things that, you take for granted. And it so he needs to do his job. And even though his boss is a little bit abusive to him, by all accounts, he's good at what he does and he enjoys what he does. At the end of the movie, he doesn't quit his job. He just stands up for himself, and it is expected that he will be going back to the office again. Despite the fact that he actually does some stuff that, like, in modern days, you'd be fired immediately. You start swinging around a golf club in your boss's office breaking shit.
Yeah.
So how do they protect him from that, right? Because his boss is not in on it.
Right,
Andrew the
right.
giant junked covert is not in on it. So, like, why don't they call a police officer and press charges for his violent outburst that he is pushed to by the actions of this? He had no anger at the beginning. And then, like, that's the thing that just does not jive with me. First impressions, still talking first impressions, I'm sorry. But the second, if it were me, right, and we're talking a real world scenario, I am sentenced to go to anger management. If when I show up at the anger management, the person who was there when it happened happens to be my therapist, I'm calling fucking shenanigans. I'm not staying. I'm going to the court. I'm going to my lawyer. I don't know who I'm going to, but I'm saying, is there another anger management program that I can go to? Because I have a conflict of interest with this therapist. He was
Exactly.
present. Like.
Exactly. And like, you don't want to sit around and like pick apart and throw logic too much at movies, but like, when the movie is going to be as aggressive towards me as this movie is, you better fucking believe I'm going to pick apart every single fucking thing, right? So like, it's one of those things where if in any other movie, this kind of twist would be adorable and fun to play with. But because this movie is so pointed at its audience, as an audience member, it's really hard to care, right? So it's really hard to like enjoy my time with it.
Yeah, it's the second he doesn't do anything, I did not know what the twist was going to be. I had somehow avoided it. It's why I said to people who might have an interest in this movie, don't watch, because we're going to spoil the big twist, the M. Night Shyamalan twist that's happened.
That was
at the
my
end of this
one
movie.
Nugget about your synopsis that I really is like, you got to let people experience it like you experience it, like I experienced it the first time, where you don't know until the end what's going on.
Right. And that's
revealing
why I told
so
people
early
to get the fuck out of here. Just get out.
Know.
Because it's such an important part about this film and how it is to be discussed, that if we didn't introduce it as early as possible, I would feel just as, like, skeezy
at, yes,
like, towards how we're treating the audience. Like, yes. I don't want to treat the audience that way. I want them to know full on, Linda, portrayed by Marissa Tomei, totally fucks up her boyfriend's life because in her opinion, he's not assertive enough. And because of that, this guy, who's a fine guy, has his life completely upended and, like, ruined. It's ruined. And then at the end, when, like, he proposes, right? Like, it's all, like, to push him to propose to her. She's such a manipulative villain. And then the happy ending is that they get married. Like, if
so
it,
just to, like, to
like, if I gotta be honest, like, if I were dating someone and they put me through all of this, get the fuck away from me. I'm walking away from that subway platform and we're done.
But the crazy thing is like, this is not something that any normal human would do. This decision to just completely warp this other human, like, right. This is not something that happens in the real world.
We hope.
This is important for what I'm about to say, Devin, is this is what leads to the creation of somebody like an incel, is because they see movies like this and they think, whoa, is this what women do? And, like, I'm not saying every kid out there is going to feel that way, but when you have hundreds of thousands of kids going to see these movies, because they're just these PG-13 comedies coming out in theaters, and you're just going to the dollar theater to see whatever, and that's the first time I saw this movie. And I don't know how I never, like, I, clearly, whatever anxiety issues that I'm dealing with in my life were developed later in life, because I don't know how I watched a movie like this when, like, and came out of it thinking, yeah, Adam Sandler comedy, not my favorite, but it's also just one of the good, you know. And the thing is, it went and it hit everybody. This is another one of those church lady ones I tell you about. When we talk about, there were just these ones that just everybody kind of latched onto. And, like, they were like, oh, yeah, I don't love Adam Sandler movies, but that anger management one, that one we could watch. Like, we would watch this at like, get-togethers and stuff. Like, this is one of the ones that would be on at the holiday. Like it's crazy to me that this is up there with things like, well, funny enough, 50 First Dates, right? Or, you know, like, Mr. Deeds is one that we've talked about this season. Like, this idea being that this was somehow the 180 that I personally have taken on this movie is crazy to me. And, like, I just don't know how I never really picked up on any of this stuff before, right? So it's why I wonder if it's the genre aging poorly and just aging out, because it needs to, right? That this like weird dark humor that revolves around, like, people with mental issues. It's like, you know, you go back to stuff like Stir Crazy with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, right? And you know, there's all sorts of weird ones.
Analyze
What's the one with
this
Dom
and
DeLuise?
Analyze that are two that
oh, yeah.
keep thinking
yeah,
pop to mind,
yeah.
which I really can't imagine. Analyze that and analyze this hitting the way they did didn't in some way fuel the making of this film with younger comedian and older, like, guy who is known to be, like, a tough man, like, yeah. as like this comedic thing. And then we're going to swip and flip it around. Flippy Swippies or whatever the fuck they're called. Flippy Slippies. It's that the Dom DeLuise one. I know the one you're talking about. I can't remember the name of it. I'm sorry.
Oh no, there's a bunch of these, right? Yeah. Like, there's a bunch of these types of comedies that play with mental illness in you know, comedic ways. I'm not saying whether or not they're successful when I say that. I'm just putting a genre on that, right? And, like, and this tries to follow that, and it just doesn't work. Like, and I can't believe it worked as well as it did, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah. I have to make a little bit of confession here. If there were an episode of the Say Report, I would have given a secret word in this episode, and that secret word would have been incel. And I did not want to be the person to say it. But as I was, like, thinking about the movie and thinking about what we were going to talk about tonight, I'm like, there's no way to prove it, but I wouldn't be surprised if we did the archaeological dig into it and found that Marissa Tomei's actions in this movie was one of those big, like, starting of the fire of that particular movement.
What it is is that there are tropes that are referred to by those groups, right, that are present here or there, and that we point to as, like, these are the triggers. These things are the things that triggered guys into thinking that this is the way that women behave, so they think they can act this way towards them, right? Like, and they're sprinkled throughout most places, right? Like salt, just sprinkled just for flavor. This movie is a fucking salt lick. That's what you're talking about. Is like, this is one of, is that it's not that this one movie we can point to as the movie that causes all problems, but when we say that there are movies out there that people were brought up on that fucked them up in some ways because of the ways that they were taught this, it's you know, you can point to here or there to little elements in films, or you can just point to a movie like Anger Management and just say the whole fucking thing.
Yeah, this is a way station on the peak of Mount Incel. This is like Camp 2. It's so... it's
fucking weird.
It really just... like, I'm glad that both of us saw this movie in 2023 and thought, yeah, this is the type of thing that could really affect a person to think that way. And, I mean, I'm not saying anything about anything there, but there's a particular trope in this film, and it is the trope of, like, she kind of wants him to quit his job. Like, I don't know why you don't quit this job. And I've never understood that. Like, complaining about your job, I mean, it's not great that you have to do it, but complaining about your job does not necessarily mean I want to quit this job, right?
Yeah, it's a hard balance, right? Yeah, because you definitely have those conversations, like, amongst your family about, like, hey, this job seems to be, like, treating you like shit. Dude, how you want to talk about that? Like that's a legit conversation to have with your partner or with your family, you know, like that's not weird. But going to the lengths of tricking your boyfriend into losing his job, because he just loses his job, but like there's no way he keeps his job after the way he behaves, right?
Maybe. I mean, we never get to see that. It totally Disney fucking fade to black, happily ever after.
Yeah, yeah.
Bibbidi bobbidi boo.
So he loses his job, right? So, like, it's just wild. Like, so no, you don't trick your family members into losing their job.
You have a discussion.
But yeah, you do talk
to
them about it.
But I also, like, he is not the one who has, like, the problems. And understand that an outside observer is going to be the one who, like, might be able to notice patterns and things that you've gone blind to. But I remember I was seeing a girl in, like, 2017. It was 2017. And she was like, why don't you just quit your job if you hate it so much? And I'm like, I don't hate my job. I don't know why you think I hate my job. I haven't really said anything to make you think that I hate my job. And really what that was, right? And this is armchair psychology 101. I'm sorry there. She had just quit her job and had, like, been able to realize the freedom that afforded her to, like, actually pursue things. And I think that she was just kind of going out and telling people, you should quit your job. But it was just so weird because she's like, you should quit your job. And I'm like, no, I actually really like my job. I'm good at my job. And, like, I need money. I don't have a sister who's going to let me move into her basement.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like I said, it's conversation, man. Like there's, yeah, you know, there's levels to it, and you got to understand when somebody is just, like, trying to get something off their chest, so you just let them kind of, you know, bitch about their job and everybody's good. Or if it's, like, a serious thing that, like, hey, like, this is deeply affecting you, we maybe need to talk about other options in your life. Those are legit conversations to have. That's the problem, is that she doesn't have a conversation with him about it in this movie. She talks at him at some point, and then her next big step is to fucking just upend his life.
Dude, the first time we see them together, she has already started to upend his life. We never get to see that conversation that inspires her to think he needs the push.
That's true, because by that point, he's Rydell's already
the
been
only thing we see
in, right?
Prior to that is what would legitimately be the type of moment in a childhood that would cause someone to develop his passive nature, right? Yeah. And his shyness. The fact that Arnie Shankman, when he was, I'm trying to do the math here, so he's 35, so when he's 10 years old and he is pantsed at a Brooklyn block party and, like, everybody sees his penis, so, like, it's really, that's the fucked up thing about this movie, right? We talk about how it has no respect for mental health or it doesn't really want to have a frank conversation about it, but it shows us the inciting action of, like, a lot of his issues, and then, like, but we're never going to explore any of those. We're not going to say the fact that, like, he's incapable of public displays of affection. Because when he was 10 years old, the first time he tried to do that, he was exposed in, like, the rawest way possible.
Well, yeah, and the closest that they get is they go to the Artie Shankman bit where they find him later, and he's now changed his name, and he's a passive monk, right? But, like... The weird resolve to that is you have to beat up this man who is clearly not the child that he was then. Like, again, you have to break somebody else. If you want to fix yourself, then you must break someone else. It is truly just watching this line of toxic masculinity just get shifted and watching it poison more and more people, because then they do break Artie.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It's Hannibal. Holy fuck. How did I not see this? This is like watching Will and Hannibal. And Hannibal's like, you must become a serial killer if you want to stop these feelings of serial killing, Will. And Will is just like, okay.
Well, I guess we know what your borrowed isn't.
I didn't think of it until just now, but fuck. I mean,
that's a pretty good one. That's pretty solid. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how to feel about this movie. The length he goes to. The fact that they introduce at the end that all of it's, like, that some of it's been a bit makes you question who was in on it. Arnie Shankman couldn't have been in on it. Was John Turturro's character, Chuck, in on it? Like, were those guys who did the bar fight and, like, the cocktail waitress, John Turturro's mom from Mr. Deeds, like, is she part of it? Like, I really hate the narrative that Dave is, like, a woman abuser. Like, that's the path they go down.
Right. But specifically, we are there to witness the events, and you are able to make decisions on your own. And so I will say, from my point of view, there is not a thing he does that merits that level of labeling, right? And so when they do label him that and everybody goes with it and we see the negative ways in which it impacts him, again, you're planting this shitty ass seed about false accusation history that just is just over the top, right? And like some point you have to wonder, are they trying to be satirical here? But there's nothing to satirize here. Like this is,
yeah, like
they're not punching up, they're not punching down, they're just punching at air.
They're punching wildly. They're just spinning. Yeah. I'm gonna be doing this with my arms, and if you get hit, that's on you. It's really kind of insane if you think about it. And that was the last thing I was gonna bring up, is like, is it, like, trying to call attention, trying to think, like, these negative accusations, these connotations, these labels, and how they can affect a person? Like, on some level, I feel like that's the message, but it is so lost in this
sea. Well, that's not exactly the best message, right? Like, 2003, a group of very extremely privileged white guys trying to say, hey, when you throw out words like abuser, like, you're really wrecking a guy's life. You know that, right? It's like, it's not the point, jackasses.
Yeah.
Like... And you know, so you just get this weird, like, cringe feeling the entire time. Like I said, I had to step outside at some point. I was like, the only reason I finished it is because I know how it ends. Like, I was like, well, now we're on the downward swing here, so we might as well go through the rest.
This movie, the pacing of this film upsets me. Just, like, I just want it to end. I know where it's going, but, like, oh, this has to happen. This still has to happen. Heather Graham and that whole friggin' I'm gonna explode in my pants bullshit. Like, Oh, and the weirdest thing, like, there's this weird moment in this movie where, like, he gets the call that his Buddy's mom has to go in for minor surgery, and, like, he tells Buddy, and Buddy has this reaction, and he's like, "Nah, I was just kidding." He's like, "No, she's still having surgery, but it's just minor surgery." But he's like, "But I should still get there." And it's like, yeah, like, you just say that, like. I guess Dave's motivations are, if he has to go see his mother for surgery, I get him off of my back. But at the same time, like, he does the right thing. It's not like he keeps it from him to punish him. It's such a weird thing. It was like, what was he supposed to do in this moment? Like, he's essentially a stranger. They haven't known each other for longer than 5 or 6 days. Because by the end of it, they've known each other for 8 days. When they're going to see Arnie Shankman, they've only been in each other's lives for 8 friggin' days. So, like, essentially a stranger. How do you tell them that, like, I just get a call, like, your mom has to go in for surgery? It's minor, but, like, I don't know you. I don't know how you're going to react to that information. Like, maybe your mother already had major surgery, so she's having these minor surgeries every so often, so it's not a big deal to you. Or maybe she is legitimately the only thing you have in your life, so hearing your mom's going into surgery is going to get that type of reaction from you.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I don't know. I just don't know.
Or a goose fraba.
Goose fraba.
So, where are we rolling next?
I think at this point we go into something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue. I mean, it seems like the next logical decision. Goose Fraba.
So, do you want to go first, or shall I?
I am going to bet on green and let you go first, hoping that your new is not my new.
I probably not. You kind of offhandedly mentioned mine earlier, and I don't think you would cannibalize yourself like that. But that is, this is one of the rare instances where we don't have the covert covert. We don't have the jerk covert. We have the successful covert. It's a new covert for us.
I mean, he's successful in bedtime stories, but he's a jerk too. And I guess that trumps successful. But,
the big thing is in this one is that he's like the joke is the big dick, right? Like there's it's above all else, this movie holds masculinity and physical representation of masculinity up as the pinnacle of, like, success, right? And then in that, they give this character that title and accessory, shall we say, right? So that idea being that, like, they put him on top. He still gets knocked down a peg by the end of the movie because he is the antagonist. And that's the other thing, is that by making him as successful and big in this movie as he is, by knocking him down, he's the closest thing to, like, the villain covert that I think we ever really get. Like, this is extremely villainous. Even in Mr. Deeds, we noted that there's a lot of things that he does because, like, it's his job to do, and, like, he cares about his, like, friend and stuff. Like, this, there's no... He's very close to almost being the Eric of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, Frank Head is closer to being the Eric of this movie, but then they're kind of in league. They're the people who would show up in the room with all of the League of Sandler villains. It would be those two trying to knock him down a peg.
Yeah, Kovair is the sycophant to Frank Head, right? Yeah.
I like that. I really enjoy that. I mean, he's so gross. I love that he went to Brown University. I think that is... I didn't get a chance to look this up. Does the ESPN Zone still exist? Because I feel like it used to be a big deal, and I'd never hear about it anymore.
The ESPN Zone? Sorry, say that again?
The ESPN Zone. It's a bar. It was a bar in New York.
Oh, yes. Yes. No, the only one that I think I knew about was there was also one in Orlando that was on Pleasure Island, which doesn't exist anymore. So I don't think that one exists. So it could be one of those things that no longer exists. I'm not up on my ESPN business. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, it's technically Disney business if you want to be, like, a real jerk about it because of how big companies and everything. But I do think that him being like, I rented the place out, you know, so it's just this Brown alum, is a great line, really shows you just how successful this asshole is. But also, it's not just the three of them in there, so it's such a weird comment.
Oh, it all, they're gone. The ESPN Zone is gone.
Yeah, that's not surprising. They
10
had
years later,
TVs over.
2013, they started going down.
They had TVs over the urinals that showed fishing. You put the game on. The Yankees are playing in New York. Why isn't the Yankee game what I'm looking at while I'm taking a whiz? What the hell? So that whole thing, and then he's like, I rented the place out, and I'm like, there's clearly extras in here, though. Like, what a weird line. Like, they could have done it. They could have demarcated it to the fact that it was just them in there. But no, there's extras in the scene. It's so weird. But I will say, of as much as I disagree with literally all of the like focus on masculinity and the biggest dick in the room, I have to give credit to the joke about, yeah, if there's 20 guys in a Laker in a locker room, I'm in like the top 18. Like, I think that's such a good joke. Even though it's gross, it's a well-crafted little comment from Adam Sandler. And again, he has so few moments of pure comedy in this movie.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing is that because he's subdued and then he's only two modes in this movie, right? Like he's either the subdued Sandler that he has to be, you know, Dave with his anxiety, or he has to be so over the top. There's no in between. And that is made all the more like necessary by pairing him up with one of the most over the top actors of all time. Going up against Jack Nicholson in this particular role, like he goes Sandler finds himself going so over the top because he doesn't have to just prove the difference between angry him and sane him. I don't know why I put it that way, but angry him and calm him, right? But he also has to make sure that he's bigger than Nicholson in moments, which is like a feat.
Yeah, it is. That is a really good point. I'd actually like to. This seems like a pretty good place to inject this. It's from Ellen Lutter. She was a costume design on Anger Management. There's a really interesting script for Adam. It's a little bit different than some of the other films. Although there's an ensemble effect with all the other characters, it was really interesting to make Adam more of a guy who toes the line and goes to work and is trying to get ahead. And honestly, nailed it. Completely nailed what is so strange about this movie
Yeah.
in terms
I
of
mean, but
just
that's
an
the
Adam
joke,
Sandler
right?
film. Yeah.
Like, take the Jack Nicholson, like, put your hand over the Jack Nicholson side of it. Don't look at that side for a second. The appeal of this as an Adam Sandler movie, the hook for this one is this one, he's the calm guy, right? Like, that's kind of the bit. And then they kind of put a hat on a hat by then bringing Jack Nicholson in, right?
Yeah. That's a good point. That's not my new. It is new that I watched special feature footage, but there's a very important reason why. And I sent it to you in a text today. I want to say it was around 3 o'clock. I put it into our Adam Sandler thread. And that's, I did it. And I found a copy, a photograph of David Dorfman, who is my new for anger management.
Okay, and
And
who the fuck is David Dorfman?
ladies and gentlemen, who the fuck is David Dorfman has been said. Cue the da-da-da-da-dun. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the David Dorfman Cinematic Universe
Oh, God.
podcast. Because we have to talk about David Dorfman. I am breaking the rules a little bit using him as a new because inexplicably, he is one of the people on the Hanukkah song part three from Eight Crazy Nights. I don't know what he did for that, but on IMDb, this guy has about 11 credits. And the reason why he is my new is because David Dorfman splashes onto the scene in 2003. He has Anger Management come out on April 11th, 2003, and then on August 22nd, 2003, he has My Boss's Daughter come out. It was originally called The Guest. The script was purchased in 1999, but then they just had difficulty getting it going, so it ends up coming out 4 months after Anger Management. Ladies and gentlemen, I am springing this on Seijin. It is for our other show, The Say Report, which releases every Monday. We're doing, as a very special episode for The Say Report, or maybe a time capsule, I don't know, we're celebrating the 20-year anniversary of My Boss's Daughter. because it requires deeper examination.
It's Ashton Kutcher, right?
It is Ashton Kutcher. It is Tara Reid. It is essentially anger management, but parsed down into one night, fulfilling the unities of drama and entertainment.
And Dorfman wrote both of them, just so that I'm keeping up here.
Yeah, Dorfman wrote both of them. They are Dorfman's only unique screenwriting credits. David Dorfman has two screenwriting credits, and it's those two. And then he is credited for Anger Management, The First Session, which is a student-directed film from a Colorado university. I'm not 100% sure. And it is literally just the first session from this movie. So, like, when he meets Lou and Chuck and John Loughran's character, I think his name's Neil. It's that whole sequence, but it ends differently, where it's revealed at the very end that Jack Nicholson is a mental patient and they're all in a mental health hospital. But it all plays out the same. It's available on Vimeo if you want to watch
it.
It's
like a really cool student project that they were cool enough to credit the original writer on. I appreciate
that. But it's weird because they credit the original writer on it, but the way that they credit the original writer does make it seem like he wrote it. Because
Well, the other thing is maybe they're a bunch of acting students. If they're a bunch of film acting students that had to put a project together and they don't want to take credit for writing because none of them feel like they quote unquote wrote it, even though they probably improvised the entire end.
So, I mean, yeah, like the end of it is changed. It's strange because it seems the way that it's written and the way that it's credited, it feels like he was part of it. Like
maybe,
you wouldn't write like based on the script originally by David Dorfman. I mean, maybe they did know him, but it's very strange. That's his third credit on IMDb as a screenwriter. And then his fourth credit on IMDb is based on the Revolution Studios film by David Dorfman on 68 episodes of the Anger Management sitcom that is technically a remake of this movie starring Charlie Sheen.
32 episodes were like, nah, we didn't touch those characters.
And I gotta tell you, that doesn't make any fucking sense to me. Because one of the ones that is omitted in all of this is the episode that I asked you to watch, which is season 2, episode 1, Charlie Loses It at the Baby Shower. Mm-hmm. Definitely has that credit at the end of it. Definitely
so it's
credits
just a miscredit
David Dorfman
on IMDb.
So it's just they didn't credit him for all of them. Because I checked all of the episodes I have, because I have access to the first 3 seasons from Amazon. They broke it up into 5 seasons.
Is that what it is?
So, yeah. It's about 20 for all the back seasons and then 10 in the front. It weirdly evens out because it's like 22, 24. Doesn't really matter. Each season is about $8. And honestly, I'm in for a penny. I'm in for a pound. I'm going to watch all 100 episodes of Anger Management at this point. But all of the ones that I have that are not credited to him are credited to him at the end of the credits. So it just seems like it's an issue. But he hasn't done anything. He hasn't written anything else. And it's because
He's living off that syndication money, man.
He's probably living off that syndication money. But I also think it's the fact that Anger Management hits and it does, what, $200 million internationally when everything is in together. And Boss's Daughter, and again, I'm promising you, I mean, it's a great way to advertise for the Say Report, but we're going to look into it. It is a flaming turd from the beginning in terms of profits and critics and everything involved in it. But
I'm compartmentalizing right now into Say Report stuff so that we don't get into more discussion about this because this is intriguing to me.
That's it.
Anger Management is like kind of his big thing then, huh?
Anger management is his biggest thing because his like weird little stepchild is My Boss's Daughter. But all of the things that I found in this guy, he is listed as one of the top 10 fresh voices in comedy in 2003. Like, everybody is talking about how he's going to be the next big thing. And he just disappears. To the point that I thought it might be like a nom de plume, like an Alan Smithy sort of situation.
Yeah, right? Somebody else was using
So I kept trying to find a photo of this guy, and I thought when I wound up on, like, I think it's FilmBug, that says that after being a writer, he became a CIA operative with 19 confirmed kills. I'm like, so I'm done, right? Like, there can't be any more to this.
Right, right.
But no. And then I'm like, you know what I have to watch? He's credited as himself. His other credits on IMDb, since I've named almost all of them, in addition to 8 Crazy Nights, the 4 screenwriting credits that I've given so far, he appears as himself in My Buddy Jack and Skull Sessions, The Making of Anger Management, which are 2 supplemental features on the DVD. And then he's a producer in 2011 on Bucky Larson, Born to Be a Star. And, like, that's it. Then he's nowhere else to be seen.
I mean, I wonder if he gets folded into the Happy Madison stuff, because they have more people, like, working for them that just don't get their name put in because they're not putting in as much money anymore, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, if he's in with them at some point and can just be, like, a low-grade, like, investor and just live off of that, because anybody invested in that company is probably still doing
probably
aces.
Making bank, right? Like
right,
just
right,
doing
yeah.
Bucky Larson probably set him up until he does the next thing, probably sometime in the next 3 years, right?
We yeah, see I mean, him that's get the thing about credit. Hollywood, right? Is, like, we think about all of the names that you can see at the end of a movie, right? Like, think of the longest series of credits you ever saw, and then combine that with all of the other movie credits you've ever seen in your life. That's still just the tip of the iceberg for people that, quote-unquote, work in Hollywood, right? Like, there are people that are doing jobs that are never going to get listed, because that's not what they're doing it for. They're doing it for, honestly, the cash. And, like, so it sounds like what happened is that this guy kind of bubbled up to the top with, like, a creative idea. But if he was really more of a behind-the-scenes guy anyway to begin with, right? Like, he just happened to have a script that just, like, somebody bought up and made. Good for him for that, like, moment, right? And the sun. But if he's not doing that, I don't want to make it sound like he, like, fell on his face with my boss's daughter and therefore is, like, was rejected from the Hollywood system. That's probably not what happened. He probably just fell back into the behind the scenes stuff again.
Yeah, it's just he had this one script, it sold, and he's able to live a pretty happy, fulfilled life off of that. It's just, it's really interesting that the guy had 2 movies come out in 2003. For all intents and purposes, my whole joke about the David Dorfman cinematic universe, we've kind of discussed it. And it was just really interesting because he had a bunch of spec scripts. Like, I went, the deepest rabbit hole that I went into was David Dorfman on this film. And it's, and I honestly, he's probably living off the syndication money from those episodes of Anger Management. And we'll get to Anger Management, the TV show, after New Old Borrowed Blue, I promise. But it is, and it's not going to be as deep as anything else that we've discussed, I don't think. But it is just really, and My Boss's Daughter and Anger Management both came to HBO Max this month, March of 2023. So I was able to watch it.
Tied up in that Dorfman deal, man.
It just, it was, it's just so strange to me, especially then to watch the movie and it to almost be the same exact thing. But again, that's going to be more Say Report stuff. And yeah, and let's move forward into old, because it feels
ahead.
Like
you,
it's
you,
old
you start
time.
Us off.
I need to get to my thing. Vamp, Siege, and Vamp.
Oh, yeah.
There it is, I found it.
Sorry, I would have thrown it to you if I realized
sorry.
It wasn't
No, I was
you.
On my John C. Reilly section of it. this is an interesting one, right? We're just talking about music and everything and David Dorfman being on that. The old that I'm going to bring is old score from Mr. Deeds is reused in this movie, because these are 2 films that are scored by Teddy Castellucci, which is insane on some level. Castellucci in Love, which is like the happy song that where everything kind of resolves in both Mr. Deeds and in this film is there. And then there's one other one I can't remember the name of, like Breaking Out or Breaking In. It's something like that. But it's from Mr. Deeds. Both of them are credited in the score. Neither one of them is on the score for Mr. Deeds, which I sought out and I tried to find them. Could not find them on there. Could not find them on the score for Anger Management. So I don't know what Teddy Castellucci is doing, but it is a name that we first saw on something like Mr. Deeds. I see it again on Anger Management. And then, just for shits and giggles, and to add just a little bit more flame to the fire, inject just a tiny bit more of TSR into this, Teddy Castellucci also happened to do the music on My Boss's Daughter. So something's going on. And we're going to solve the greatest, like, question of Hollywood.
Yeah,
but not on this episode.
I have an answer for you, but I want to roll a little bit before we get to it.
Yeah, okay.
So, Because my old, this is going to be a quick one because it was quick in the movie, so there's not too much to talk about. But we haven't seen him in a while, but Meatball was in this movie.
Well, Meatball the cat.
No, Meatball the dog is in this movie.
No,
So it's
where is
obviously
Meatball the
been spawned.
dog?
Then one moment when they really early in the movie, I think we've already seen Buddy Rydell, not yet named, I think, on the plane, right? Or I don't know if he, but we've already seen Buddy Rydell on the plane. We have not yet met him as the head of the therapist of the group. But there's a moment that flashes the back of his book, and his author picture on the back of the book is Jack Nicholson and Meatball.
Oh, I missed it. I did have as my old Meatball in name and spirit with the cat. That poor cat put into a fat suit. I feel so bad for that cat.
Don't know, that cat got those crab cakes. Honestly, that cat had the best movie for me. Like, out of all the characters to follow, that cat was doing all right. Because, like, Dave very much cared about that cat.
Yes, he did. That's why he wanted to dress him so chic. That's good. If that's your old, that's good. That's a good quick old. I do have a bonus old because so much of this movie reminded me of Big Daddy, right down to the fact that he's got a gay lawyer. I have to imagine that maybe one of the lawyers that like Happy Madison was working with was a homosexual, and like it's a subtle nod to them.
I don't
All of
know,
these gay
man.
lawyers in these things. I mean, the apartment kind of feels like the loft from Big Daddy. It is
Yes, yeah.
definitively not, because one of those special features I watched talks about the fact that they had to find the perfect apartment, and it was that one with the army billboard that they're
Nice.
like, we're going to shoot in this apartment.
Oh,
So
man.
it's not the one from Big Daddy, but it feels like it. Like there's so much there. But then the fact that like that's my lawyer. My lawyer's gay. His husband, his boyfriend's gay. And then also like Clint Black is the masseuse in that moment because Clint Black, I guess. Country star Clint Black. Just okay.
Yeah, this movie
He
has a lot
jumps
of those
off the
kinds of
boat.
moments
In
of
Maverick. That's what I know Clint Black for.
I mean, this movie has those kinds of moments all fucking over it. January Jones showing up.
January Jones, here's a fun thing. I'm sorry that I've turned this into the Say Report like thing. This is going to be a year for January Jones and things that Sijin and I are involved in. So
Okay.
stay tuned for that. Because it's just like, oh, January Jones was apparently like hot in Hollywood in
Sometimes you say
2003.
things and they sound more threatening than I think you mean
That's
them.
not what I meant at all. I mean that she's going to be celebrated this year in a lot of things.
Oh,
And I'm
man.
excited about it. It really is exciting. So I was excited to see January Jones as she's Gina, right? Yeah, she's Gina. Stacy
Yeah.
is the other one played by Krista Allen. The two adult film stars. And January Jones is missing a toe. It's a shame she couldn't turn into diamond form in this movie. Sorry, I'm a madman. Okay.
Oh,
Shtick
man.
off. Let's get to Borrowed, which I'll let you go first on this one, because I want to
Okay.
see what you say.
Well, so I think you probably already know what it is because I was reaching out to you about it today.
Oh, do you?
But this movie straight up borrows an entire scene from Tomcats, which Devin went on to discover. I will give you full credit for this. Went on to discover that the reason this is probably in this movie is not only does it feature an SNL alum, Horatio Sanz, in it, who is like the butt of the joke, but on top of that, it's also Revolution Films' first movie, which was what, like 2 4 years before this? Tomcats is 99, right?
Tomcats is 2001.
2001, even, yeah, even, okay, man, yeah, so like 2 years previously, right? Like Revolution Films only has just started. This is one of their first films, and they give a shout out to their first movie, Tomcats.
Revolution Studios, just to
Thank
make
you.
sure that we don't get sued for not naming them properly. It is
Yeah, because that's how that works.
that's I don't know. I don't want to, that. Come on, CJ. If we're gonna open ourselves to for like litigation, I don't want it to be
Yes,
over
please. We will be
Tomcats.
the podcast sued by Revolution Studios.
They'll acquire us and then they'll do a weird sequel to it. Because that's what they're known for. No, it was, yeah, the fact that it's their first movie. And what better way to call attention to their first movie and maybe get some eyes on it than, like, sneaking it into this Adam Sandler film? Oh, you like comedy? Watch this comedy. But, you're missing important plot points.
So you were just kind of like you were, yeah. I think the reason that we see all of this weird stuff happening in this movie, where you're like, why is this person here? Why was this call made? Who brought this guy in? It's because it seems like what this is this is Revolution Studios trying to do whatever they can, like to make sure that they've got a successful film on their hands, right? Like they realize that they've probably got a pretty hot potato here with Adam Sandler, right? And they're just going to do anything that they can to make sure that this movie hits, and it does, luckily for them. But like, yeah, it's in no small part because of all of the strings that they pull to make this movie.
Yeah. And this is definitely, like, Revolution Studios is putting a lot into it. To the fact that, like, their name is all over the anger management TV show in 2012. Yeah. By the end, that it ends everything. But Joe Roth, who is, like, the big brainchild who left Disney to go on and form Revolution Studios, especially, of all people, Julia Roberts was, like, one of the first people who invested. And that's why Mona Lisa Smiles happens. Some really just crazy stuff. I went down a pretty deep hole about Revolution Studios, too. So I thank you for that. I did kind of hope that that meant I could sneak Tom Katz in as my borrowed. But, you know, consummate professional, I have a backup. Is the Joker, baby? they put Jack Nicholson into that beret. And all I could think of when he's in that beret is that friggin' purple beret that he is wearing in the art museum scene from Batman 1989.
Yep. So like, yeah, he completely embodies the Joker in so many different ways in this movie.
Yeah.
He also carries the same stance as the Joker.
Yeah.
You notice that with like his like chest out and he's like looking down his nose, so he almost looks like cross-eyed half the time, and he smiles. Like this giant ass smile.
He does the Joker and smile.
Then, right. Like definitely like prosthetically helped in the 89 Batman, but not much.
No, not by much. I mean, yeah, like his cheeks are not stretched up the way that they are in the movie. But like so much of Buddy Rydell is the Joker. And, you know, they put the beautiful cap on it by showing the first husky cat outfit that Kitty Cat Meatball wears is a purple sweater with a purple fucking beret. It's like, in case you didn't get what we're trying to do here, huh? The Joker, man. It's the Joker, baby. And it's it was my borrowed, because there's so much of it. Also,
there is also. Oh, go ahead.
No. I mean, also, so much of it felt borrowed, but then it wasn't. Like it was just weird facsimile.
Yeah, I was going to say that, like, there's also, I mean, in a nod to a lot of these kinds of movies in the past that have dealt with this, like, you can see straight-up references to, like, Taxi Driver and things like that, especially in, like, John Turturro's character, right?
Yeah. Oh, God, John Turturro's character. He also kind of feels like Driver because of that satin jacket that does a lot of the heavy lifting for the Chuck character.
Oh,
I'm just going to be honest with you. When he freaking switches it inside out, is just so good. And by all accounts, that was just John Turturro riffing. So, like, he's so good. We didn't talk enough about him. And, like, also as old, the fact that, like, he's in it and then the cocktail waitress is his mother from Mr. Deeds. I alluded to that. Like, there's some fun in it. There's also, like, Sid Gaines, who's someone that we haven't talked about before. He's been appearing in a bunch of these Adam Sandler films with, like, very little credit from us. He's the one who's like, hey guys, could you calm it down a little bit? We're trying to
Definitely feels like that old Adam Sandler trope of bringing everybody in, right? Because you also get Kevin Nealon showing back up, right? Jonathan Loughran, right? Like, as one of the other guys in the group with him. Like you get that all over the place in this one.
But I mean, that's ultimately what you just said is probably why I'm leaning towards my decision on this movie. But that's a discussion for after Blue. And I'm going to go right here with the Blue. Is Buddy Rydell's neck brace for me at the very end is so baby blue.
Should be a hint that it's probably not real then, right?
Right? Like, but everybody's in on it, right? It's Lynn Thigpen's Judge. Oh, God. Didn't even think about that this.
Yeah, but he got a bespoke neck, like,
neck brace,
neck brace. Yeah, just like personally made. Yeah, might as well monogram it.
Yeah.
Fuck. So good. That's great, Dev. The blue that I focused on, because there was so much to choose that we haven't actually talked about yet, so I think I'm glad that I chose this as my blue. The amount of gay panic on display in this movie, and specifically the thing I will point to is Luis Guzman's character in this film. Like the level at which this movie depends on the fear of homosexuality for like the joke is just on a level that we have again seen in small doses in other movies, right? I always think back to like the ways that like Clint Howard as the cross-dressing man and Waterboy, right? Wasn't that the one?
No, he's cross-dressing in Little Nicky.
Little Nicky, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so just recently in terms of chronology.
Chronologically, yeah.
What? Yeah, thanks. That word got real lost in my tongue. But the like so again, not like a surprise, it's just the level at which it is present in this film, it is hard to impossible even to ignore, right? Like, but then it comes out in other little places too, right? Like for instance, the moment when they sing
I
from
feel
West Side
pretty.
Story there, I Feel Pretty, right? And there's that entire moment where like he has to say the word gay and he hesitates on it because he doesn't want to say the word gay about himself. Like it is just everywhere in this film, right? There's just all of this stuff about him not wanting to be perceived as gay, called gay, talk about being gay or at all, or be around gay people, really. It just sucks.
It's never explored, like, and not that it should be explored, not there, but like, it comes from nowhere, right? Like some actual thing, like if he had accidentally, like if he had been going in to kiss Sarah Plowman, and then he accidentally kissed Arnie Shankman, and then he freaking pantsed him. Like, it's not part of his origin story. It's not part of like those moments that like traumatized him as a child. It just comes from nowhere as this weird holdover of the gay panic from the end of the 90s, and also like you're not a man's man, then you might as well be a fairy, right? Like that weird fucking mentality that was so pervasive in the 2000s.
It's just, and it's wild because like you think about the idea that again, this is not something that's foreign to other films of the era. Like this is happening all over. It's just the level at which it happens in this movie. It's just the movie. Like it's just, this is just what the movie is, folks. It's all of that shit that people talk about how toxically masculine and like toxic masculinity was explored through these films and perpetrated. Like you know, like this, it just. It is beyond me. Like watching this movie in 2023, I was just like, I can't believe this is a movie that existed in front of my eyeballs. Like I just never really thought about it before.
I mean, for me, like Mixed Nuts is still rumbling around in my mind, right? Because it was only three, four movies ago. And to see how Adam Sandler's character in Mixed Nuts treats Liev Schreiber to how his character in Anger Management treats Galaxia is night and day. And then, like, the other really crazy thing is, like, it would be something if they had, like, some connection, that time where he's like forced to talk to this, you know, feminine presenting male prostitute in the back of the car. If like, 'cause then Galaxia's like, I can't stop love, when he runs into her out of the outfit as Gary the security guard at the in Yankee Stadium. Like, it's like he didn't do anything to earn that goodwill. Like, wouldn't it have been cool if he had done something, or like just been really accepting, or had this conversation? Like, it's so freaking weird because by all accounts,
It would have benefited the narrative for him to actually not be such a fucking douche in that moment, right?
yes, it really would have benefited the narrative. And but what we're all saying is that Dave, by all accounts, is this nice, good guy who is systematically torn apart by the machinations of Buddy Rydell. And like, but that was already there. That part was there. That is not brought out by what Buddy is saying or
Oh,
anything like that.
his homophobia? Yeah, no, that is like an innate part of this character that we're supposed to believe is a good person, right?
But yeah, and it's there, and it's also like, but then he has the thing like, but my lawyer's gay, and it's like, yeah, it's like the reason why he should be uncomfortable in that moment is because of the prostitution of it all, not the prostitute that gets into the car.
Right.
Like, it's,
yeah,
it's,
it implies that if a prostitute got into the car that was a woman, and if led, or at least identified as, right? That
he would biologically not be, a woman, yeah.
Yeah, that he would not be feeling this way, right? Like, there's this weird connotation to, it's, yeah.
It's so strange. But then, like,
and it's
at
a
the
brain
end,
worm, man. It gets it gets into a kid, and it, you know, it forms an opinion about, like, the ways that the world works. And, like, maybe not because of this one thing that they see, but if they see this thing everywhere, and then they come to this and see it distilled as much as it is, it builds up over time, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's, yeah, you're not wrong about the gay panic. And then, like, yeah, Luis Guzman's character, and then, like, weirdly, one of the strongest characters in the remake, like, they kind of borrow sort of heavily from that group, yeah, for like Charlie Goodson's group, but not like one to one in any way, shape, or form. But there is Patrick, who is the homosexual character in Charlie's group in the Anger Management TV show, and it's like he's there because of the Luis Guzman character.
Yeah.
There's no way that, like, that's not the one-to-one there. Just like Lacey in the TV show is meant to represent the two adult film stars, Gina and Stacy, which is made really strange. It's not in the episode that you watch. It's the next episode where her sister shows up, and they really, like, are kind of mirroring stuff that Gina and Stacy were doing in the movie. But yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, that you're not wrong with that, Blue. And it's sort of the one that stands out like a major.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of other bullshit in this movie. Like, the way that women are treated in this movie as just simple objects that just, like, can affect a man's mood like fucking pills or something. Like, it's crazy. Like, the entire, like, Heather Graham scene is just untenable. Like, I had to, like, basically just look away for a while.
You know what the blue is for me? Your definition of blue, not my definition of blue. Making sure that I get those words out there. It really, really bothers me that, like, they make the... They, first of all, Dave is painted as this woman abuser, right? All of this stuff. And then when he goes to confront Arnie Shankman, Jack Nicholson's character makes up the story about him taking advantage of his sister, who was put into a mental institution for losing her mind, saying that he would tell her that she had ghosts in her clothes, so she had to get naked, and then Dave would take advantage of her, which, like, is gross. But then the capper to that scene, right, is him going, I do feel bad about all those times I molested his sister, though. And it's like the one moment in the entire feature where Buddy Rydell breaks. So it's like kind of this interesting thing. If you're looking at, watching it, waiting for the other shoe to fall, like, it's that moment where, like, you realize that Buddy is putting on an act, and then he's like, ah, got you. I was just joking about molesting the girl who lost her mind. And, like, it's not funny. That does not hit for me at all. Like, it was the moment, that moment where, like, you had to stop it and walk away. That would have been the moment for me. But I had already just said to you, what the fuck is this movie, when John C. Reilly showed up?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I had already been like, this movie just wants to do whatever the fuck it wants to do. And yeah. I guess I have to go along for the ride.
This movie's on like a drunken bender, and, like, you're kind of stuck in the back seat while they go from bar to bar.
Yeah. You're stuck as the designated driver. And if
no,
you don't,
it implies you have some control, and at any point could just run the car into a ditch.
I mean, you say that, but if I run the car into the ditch, I go to jail. One car from the drunken guys in the back, and I go to jail. So I have to keep taking them to the bars, or I go to jail. Like, would he really go to jail? Like, that's the other thing. Like,
yeah,
is that just a veiled threat the whole time?
Going to jail.
It's gross. It's gross. The movie's gross. I can't get through it. Which now it feels like, I mean, we've talked a little bit about it, but the Anger Management TV show is kind of anger management only in name.
Yeah. I had, like, when you first went down this road of watching the show, I was like, we should definitely reference the show, but not 200 or whatever, 100 episodes worth of it. Like, don't do this to yourself. Watch a couple of episodes so that you can talk about it, but then walk away. But you kept going down this hole, man. And I'm not surprised to find out that, hey, after a while, 100 episodes of a TV show has to kind of grow a little bit beyond the we're like that Adam Sandler thing.
So the really strange thing about the show is the first season, the first 10 episodes of the show really kind of feels like it's adapting Adam Sandler movies and ideas that came before it, which is interesting to me. Like Selma Blair is in the show as this Charlie's friend with benefits slash his therapist. Amazing conflict of interest there. I just like pointing it out.
I mean, also one of the biggest tropes ever.
Yeah,
It's in the
exactly.
entire series of Lucifer, but go on.
Cheers, right? Frasier and Diane fall in love in season 3, and he was originally her therapist. The Cheers theme song has a whole thing about, and your shrink ran off to Europe and didn't even write, which is like supposed to be vaguely veiling that coming on later on in the series. So, like, it's a thing that happens, but her character in the first episode dresses just like Liv Tyler's character from Reign Over Me. Like, and her hair
Interesting.
and her style, and I'm just like, well, that's kind of strange. And then just, I mean, by eventually, some other, like, I listened to a couple of other Adam Sandler podcasts just to see, after we've recorded our stuff, to see if, like, we were completely off base with our analysis. And one of the things they talk about with Adam Sandler is his big shorts. Like, Charlie Sheen has just started dressing like Adam Sandler in the show, as if they got the note, like, it's not enough like the Adam Sandler movie. And their response was, we're going to dress Charlie Sheen like Adam Sandler.
Yeah, they're going to go the blue collar route, right? I have to say that, like, for the first season, it's always that thing that nowadays where the first season of a series is never a guarantee what the rest of it's going to be. You know, Parks and Rec kind of broke that mold for everybody, but even this is, I think, even earlier than that, right? But that idea being that, like, when they first originate the idea for that show, we're going to make a movie based off of the Adam Sandler movie Anger Management. We can't use anything from the movie to make it, so it's just going to be kind of an homage to it. I can see the logical leaps to eventually getting to that's just what the whole show is it's just homages to Adam Sandler shit. Because that's the only reason people are coming to this thing, right? Supposedly. Charlie Sheen is definitely the big reason to go to, like, that people were going to that. But, like, that is, like, the train wreck they were hoping to go see. I'm not even saying it was a train wreck or not. This is not me passing judgment on anything. But I'd be remiss to not point out that this is after he got kicked from Two and a Half Men. And so everybody was kind of like sitting on their hands, waiting to see what Charlie Sheen was going to do next. What crazy thing can we watch him drive himself, you know, even deeper down this deep, dark road? Like, we're just going to sit back and enjoy it. And this is what came out. So, like, you're coming for the Charlie Sheen, but it's also weird that it's Anger Management, the TV show, right? So in that regard, you know, what are they going to do? Well, let's just do a whole bunch of Adam Sandler shit. And I think the bigger problem is that they didn't expect the people coming for the hate watching with Charlie Sheen to stick around as long as they did, because they realized, holy shit, we have an actual show on our hands, like a hit. And Charlie Sheen's able to use that later to renegotiate what the rest of that series becomes, which is why it basically becomes its own thing after season two, right? Or in season two.
Well, I mean, even in season one, like, it's weirdly, it's so strange. It's like, oh, we're gonna have these little nods to it. Michael Boatman's in the show, which makes me really happy because of them working together on something like Spin City. And he's this great thing. And he actually has a thing where he's like, hey, you want to go see the new Adam Sandler movie? And that's like kind of the lampshade on the lampshade, the hat on the hat on a hat, and now the Tower of Hats has fallen. And he's like, I just wanted to see Adam Sandler get kicked in the nuts. And it's like, all right, at this point, they've said his name. So, like, they kind of weirdly move on from it. But the big thing that you're talking about, and for me, especially in things that we have examined on the Say Report specifically, it has a lot of Hot Shots feeling to me. Like, with all the idea of, like, Hot Shots is not just a parody of Top Gun, which is sort of how they sell it, but it sort of grows into this is a parody of Tom Cruise and the movies that Tom Cruise is doing. And so then watching that, so having that in my mind, knowing that that's what Charlie Sheen has, like, been capable of in the past, there you go. When you get to Anger Management and it's
let's
straight
give
up
it the
Charlie Sheen doing, like, a parody homage sort of sampling of what represents Adam Sandler. And the last episode that I watched of the series is the highest rated episode on IMDb. I had to skip a little bit ahead to do it. It's called Charlie and the Devil, and he is dressing like Adam Sandler, and has got a lot of feelings about Little Nicky in it. Like, it's and that's like episode 18 of season 3. So, yeah. Like, you're pretty deep into the anger management ride by the time they're doing that episode.
Well, and it makes sense that that's the kind of thing that he might want to do while he's in the position he's in after Two and a Half Men, because when he's taking, when you're taking shots at somebody like Sandler, just like back in the day when you were taking shots at somebody like Tom Cruise, you're taking shots at the establishment, because yeah. These are the guys that are, these are the do no wrong guys. No matter how bad the movie might seem to everybody, they still make enough money to make everybody happy, right? So we may not love the movie while we're watching it, but we sure do love the house it bought, right? That old chestnut. I think that was Michael Caine talking about Jaws 4, right?
Yep.
Like, but that idea being that he likes that kind of concept, right? Especially when you're kind of at a point where you feel like Hollywood has maybe stomped on your nuts for a little bit, and you want to fucking kick back, right? And this is him kicking back. And I can't say whether he's right or he's wrong to feel that way, but when he is in that mood, he does produce some pretty stellar work, you know, and work that sticks around. Because the other thing is that anger management ends up becoming so successful for them that like FX ends up running like day marathons of it, like they did with The Simpsons. There's an entire channel on Roku dedicated to just showing it, just constantly, right? Like, once it hit that syndication number that it needed to, like, it got bought up fast. So I like the show is a success, yeah. At least successful enough to make everybody that was making it feel like they did the right thing, right?
Yeah, it might not be on any broadcast channels, but it has been in syndication since it wrapped up in 2014, like, continuously. The fact, like,
I mean,
Roku,
I have stayed in,
Tubi,
like, I have stayed in, like, Airbnbs that have, like, a Roku TV or Pluto TV or whatever, and there's an anger management channel, right?
Yep.
Like, so I, yes. Yeah, so.
It's this crazy thing, and I never would have thought, I would have never guessed that this is the movie that begat that show. Like, it's just, it's so crazy. And the other thing about it, right, and this is the thing, right, we're talking about the remake and how it was remade. The great thing about it, like, Charlie Sheen has this whole meltdown, right? And luckily he has the support of his family. He has Sheen Estevez Productions to, like, help him put together this program. But then the fact that he reaches out to someone like Brett Butler, who had also had a falling out with Chuck Lorre, and offers her a role in this show so that mm-hmm. she's in it. The fact that, like, he was one of the big people behind the decision to, all right, then we're doing 90 episodes right now. We're going to write, we're going to shoot, we're going to produce 90 episodes of this series so that we're in syndication and anybody who is willing to go on this journey with me is taken care of for the rest of their life. Like, there's some weird altruistic type of stuff going on. And come to find out, like, in 2015, when it's all wrapped up, that whole meltdown from Charlie Sheen, and this is just stuff that I've read on the internet, but, like, this is seems to be the timeline, at least how he drew it in the Today Show interview, was him finding out that he was HIV positive and that being his reaction to it.
Yeah.
I is mean, just this big
shit.
Public
he was
meltdown.
A, I mean,
like,
here's the thing. He has always had this side to him, right?
Yes.
Like this is that element to him has always been present. He seemed to have it under control for a while, and hence where Two and a Half Men really started to kick off. And then, you know, you start to hear the stories about his misbehavior again, and then at some point that diagnosis comes through and he just goes completely off the deep end. And, like, yeah, he's got one of the most tragic stories in these cases. And the fact that he's able to hold himself together to do these kinds of projects is cool. It is something to take a look at. You know, you can't forget, like, he did fucking, like, he did wreck people's day, right?
Oh,
there were,
yeah, no.
There were days where he was not everybody's favorite person. So, like, Charlie Sheen is not, like, some angel here that was just done dirty by Chuck Lorre. There are plenty of other people like that we could point to.
Yes. But I do like that rather than just continue down that road. He was pretty angry. That was what led to it. And he's like, so let's do an anger management show.
Yeah, I got it. So, like, how does that, I just need to know how that conversation starts. Who goes to who? Like, do they develop this idea and then go to somebody and say, can we do this as an anger management show? Or does somebody out there develop an anger management show, go looking for somebody, and then just happen to just right time, right place, run into somebody like Charlie Sheen, right?
By all accounts, it seems like a peanut butter and chocolate Reese's sort of situation.
Ooh, man, it's just wild to me that like this just exists in the world.
It just sort of happened to happen. But what the other thing that I will say, right, especially as we've talked about the film, the Adam Sandler film, being so bad about like mental health and trying to like understand and normalize and like try to get to the bottom of it, the show. And I think it probably comes a lot from what Charlie Sheen was going through in that moment and had been going through in his life, does approach it like the actual mental health of it with like better. It does it better. It doesn't do it perfectly because I don't think anybody in America is ready to have a frank discussion about mental
health.
Well,
it talks from a place of experience, at least, which already puts it miles ahead of the movie, right? Like the ways in which it's addressing things like therapy and group sessions and conversations. And one of the things that I noticed, because you did have me watch one episode, right? And one of the things that I really noticed is the ways in which Charlie Sheen talks when he's talking to his sister, because the entire episode is about him having to go and see his sister after 10 years, and she's a big trigger for his anger issues. The ways in which he like, the terminology he uses, the patterns he uses, the kinds of ways in which he talks, sounds like somebody that has been to a counselor, and these are the ways that they've been told that they need to start expressing themselves. Like, the language he uses is clearly something that he picked up himself probably at some point in some session somewhere, right? Like, you just, like, there's an informed nature to the show that just doesn't exist in the movie. That being said, yeah, the show also is not stellar at the ways in which it handles certain aspects to it, right? Like, I just, you know, there's some conversations that happen that, what it is that the show becomes very much a soapbox for Sheen's beliefs, right? Yes. Much like those shows always eventually become Last Man Standing for Tim Allen, and what Roseanne tried to do when she brought her show back and the kibosh got put on that, because turns out that, like, just because you get a soapbox doesn't mean you get to say everything on your mind. But, you know, that's kind of part and parcel with doing this. Like I said, this is definitely the Charlie Sheen show. They just put this veneer over it of this, like, Adam Sandler nature. And it doesn't surprise me that the first season leans more into the Adam Sandler than later stuff does. But I'm glad to hear that never really goes away, because, like, something about this movie sparked this, like, idea somewhere for somebody.
Yeah. I don't know. I dig it. Honestly, the reason why I wanted you to watch that episode of out of every episode of the series, the 1% of the show I wanted you to take in, it really surprised me with the B story with Ed's daughter and everybody just assuming that she was gay because of, like, the tropes and stereotypes that we put upon people in the everyday world. And the resolve of that is like, no, I'm really into dudes. Like, I'm very sexually active. I like having sex. You're just my father, so I'm not going to talk to you about that. Like,
yeah, I mean, like, it's a good bit. Like the script flipped of, because everybody assumes that she's a lesbian and then it turns out that she's not. I think I'd enjoy it more in better hands, especially because at the end of the day, that doesn't teach that guy to stop being homophobic. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it didn't resolve the real issue at hand that's being discussed there, right?
Yeah. And I don't know if he'll ever have that fixed, but where I currently am in the series, he is living with Patrick because of a prank gone wrong. And a lot of that is being addressed for that character. Like, I'm really impressed with some of the, like, overarching storylines and growth that these characters are having, because you wouldn't expect it in that way. Like, it's going to be a sitcom, but, you know, by the nature of the fact that, like, we're going to write 90 episodes of this series right here, they can play with continuity and making sure that things are remembered so much better. Like, they have it all planned out. Yeah.
Right. But imagine if this B plot that we're talking about had come later in his arc, where he was developing a better understanding of homosexuality. And so the conversation that he then has with his daughter comes from a place of compassion, right?
Yeah.
That's how you tell that joke, right? Then it's funny because everybody in the room is safe. That's the problem with this, with telling that story, with him still being in this place of still hating gay people, is at the end of that episode, you feel like, well, fuck, now we're all assholes and nobody's safe, right? There's no warmth to that, right? Like, so if you're trying to make that effort, if you're trying to say, we're going to be the ones that talk about these issues, but in a safe space, but then don't generate a safe space to do it for the joke, that sucks. You're failing. You're not doing a good job at that.
The inherent issue that I guess I would identify in the show is the fact that at the end of the day, it still has to be a sitcom. Mm-hmm. Like it's yep. not one act plays or anything yep. like that. So
no,
like,
yeah, for sure.
So you have that idea of Charlie is sleeping with his therapist, 'cause that's classic sitcom trope. Like 101, yeah. right?
And also extremely fucking problematic when you're trying to do a show that is quote unquote progressive in any way,
right.
because you can't get up on your soapbox and wag your finger at everybody and tell them how progressive they need to be, where they need to consider about how all women deserve to have choices about what to do with their bodies, but then also then have the ending bit be that, like, she's just like, okay, I'm just going to use you now, though, right? Because to my understanding, she's not there by the end of this series, right?
Yeah, so eventually, and it's because, I mean, Selma Blair said that she had difficulty working with Charlie Sheen. So yeah, he's not some saint or anything like that. He still is difficult to work with. There are stories from the series. I'm trying to stay away from them until I get through all 100 episodes. And I really wish I could have done it before we recorded this episode, but I didn't have the opportunity to. And I'm sorry for that. I will apologize to the audience for it. I'm going to stick with the show, though. I do know that. But it is one of those things where I am impressed that eventually they like realized there's no more gas in this tank. We've done every possible story we could, and the two of them sever their friends with benefits relationship and just go to being friends. Like that surprised me that yeah. like that is gone, and now they're like working on an academic study together, and I don't know how it's eventually going to go bad. I just know that there have been episodes where instead of Selma Blair, it's Laura Bell Bundy. So something happens somewhere.
Right. Yeah. So there is definitely progress being made between it and the movie. This is something I think we talked about early on, right? Like
yeah.
this idea being that, like, when you compare it to what's going on in the movie, it is miles ahead in trying to do this stuff with a sense of humor. But, you know, it still doesn't get it right. And maybe more to the point, this other thing that you said, how can you? It's never going to be right. It's just, can you do it? Can you be kind enough as you can be in the moment? And that's not necessarily a question I feel like this movie ever asked, you know, just to get back to the meat of the matter.
Yeah.
Is like, I don't think this movie ever cared at any point to give a shit about actual concerns of anger management and therapy or anything like that. This entire movie is all about the bit of, you know, let's get Sandler into bed with a naked Jack Nicholson because that's going to set off his anger. Apparently just being next to a naked man is enough to drive this man crazy.
I got to tell you, that's something that happened to me in real life too. It was a band trip and the bunkmate was mad at me. So what he did was got naked in the bed that we were sharing. And then I'm like, I don't give a fuck that you're naked. I'm
and
closed.
And then Devin went to sleep.
I went to sleep. He's like, I'm going to get you. And then I'm like, night. I just rolled over and went to sleep. So, like, yeah, it's like, and that was maybe pre this movie or post this movie. Come to find out that person, he ripped off a lot of his bits from movies. Like, I never saw
so,
Signs.
Yeah, maybe,
but that night that he stayed over at the house and just put half-filled glasses of water everywhere, that suddenly came into focus years later.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it is a... It's one of those, but also let us final thing about remakes to that. That's 9 years time, and that's pretty impressive to go from this movie where legitimately one of the like plot points and what we're trying to do from Siegel, from Dorfman is what if you're in anger management and it's your therapist that's making you angry? Ha ha, laughs forever, and
yeah.
It's just like. No, that sounds terrible. Like that's not a funny situation. it gives me the shivers. People who watch Uncut Gems and are like, this is too tense for me. It's like, hold my beer, anger management. Like, just...
Yeah. I told you, it triggered something.
Yeah,
I started to have my early stage panic attack signs that I luckily have now mature enough
that
to
you
like
can
recognize.
Identify, right?
Yeah.
All right. So we're at that point now where we have to pass judgment. And I guess the last thing I'm going to say is, I understand this getting the TV show treatment 9 years later, but I don't think this is a movie that you could remake, just like with Longest Yard. I think that things that we know now about society, mental health, like, if you tried to do a movie where the guy is just getting, like, wound up and gaslit by his therapist, people would not fucking stand for it.
Yeah, no, 100%. There'd have to be some very specific contextual strings applied to it, right? Yeah. Like, you know, it's like the thriller aspect of it has to be acknowledged, right? Like, that's the first thing, the first key point to it, is it would never be able to be this straight up absurd, like cartoonish comedy.
Dark comedy, yeah.
Yeah, there'd have to be some thriller edge to it. So, yeah, I don't know. I could definitely agree with you on that. I mean, I'm pretty sure where my judgment lies for this and subsequently because of this last month's episode as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not. This specifically, for me, is not in our Adam Sandler cinematic universe at all.
Yeah, and I think because of it, now that I look back on what has become the Peter Seagal trilogy that we've looked at over the years, they're just not, none of them are, right? They don't quite click with what's going on in the ASCU. There is definitely elements brought to it by the very nature of Sandler being there and being part of the production of them all, but that's not enough to just make them part of the whole thing, right? There is something in these movies that is not quite present in the ASCU movies, and I can't necessarily put my finger on it. Like, there's just, I mean, it's represented by a lot of the rules that we talk about, right? Like, one of the big things is that there's usually in our ASCU films, there's usually a female character that is present. She's the love interest of some kind, but she's often successful on her own, and she's got her own thing going on, and Sandler kind of comes into their life. And they could give or take Sandler. It's just by the very nature of just him being charming and them being, you know, interested in him, that, like, they allow him to affect them. But at any point, they can pull the ripcord, right? Like, they're always in a position to do that. And that's just not been present in any of these movies. The women that he is interested in, if there is a woman in the story that's, like, focused on, like, is, like, not really in need of him in any way, right? I mean, completely absent in Longest Yard. And then in this one, like, she's the one kind of being the true villain of this entire piece. We won't get into that. And then the only other one is 51st Dates, right? Yeah. Where she's definitely in a position where she needs support and help, and like his presence is affecting her on a level to the point where when he tries to remove himself or she tries to remove him from her life, she gets sicker without him. Like, she ends up going to the hospital. I mean, I guess it's implied that she's getting a little bit better, but she still dreams of him. She still needs him, right? It's like the complete opposite of that concept that we came up with for the ASCU.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote that down specifically with this one, is that it's not that a woman ever needs to be saved by Adam Sandler, but in this movie, completely flying in the face of that, it is a woman who feels that she must save him. I need to get him off of this negative track that he's on. And that negative track that he's on is just kind of being like an average guy.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
he doesn't want to stir the fucking pot and lose his job.
Yeah. He just, like, he needs to be more masculine. He needs to be more manly, man. And it's
like,
just like,
I don't, like, I feel weird because I don't want to deny the fact that, like, you should learn to stick up for yourself, right? Like, if you're being mistreated by your boss, of course you shouldn't be mistreated by your boss. And you need to be able to talk about that with your partners. And you need to be able to and maybe you do need to possibly go to a therapist to express the fact that you don't know how to talk to your boss about being mistreated. This is just one example, right? It's not that I feel like he couldn't be more assertive if he wanted to be. There's just, we're never given that moment of him, like, hating himself for the person that he is. He seems to only be, like, pushed into changing because of everybody else feeling he needs to be pushed into changing, you know?
Yeah, and that's gross. That's gross. We need to see that moment where he wants to fight for himself.
Right.
And he doesn't
know
how.
But he just can't. Yeah, he doesn't know how, right.
And, like, the fact that that never comes is just, like, this poor fucking dude is being manipulated.
Yeah, and I think that that's another key for all of this, is that Sandler doesn't really ever kind of decide for himself to be a better person in this one.
Right.
You know, we do see that in Longest Yard.
Yes, it's there. It's definitely
but
there.
Weirdly,
But
we don't see it in 50 First Dates because, as we kind of talked about then, he doesn't have much of a character arc. Like, the nice guy he is at the beginning of that movie is the nice guy he is by the end of it, right?
He's actually kind of despicable, too. I mean, I rewatched 50 First Dates last week when I was home working from home with the snowstorm. We had it on in the background. And it's just like, yeah, he's kind of despicable. Like, it's just, like, the lying to the people, and they get this great story, but also, he's using those women. Like, that whole speech to Missy Pyle about, like, you're not actually drunk, you just think that you're drunk so that we can have vigorous sex together. Like, him coming clean, it's supposed to be, like this nice moment, but also, like, hearing it all laid out is like, ugh. Like, you've done this to a lot of other people. We've seen that. With no remorse.
Yeah, so like, it's just not. There's that element of joy missing from these that just don't quite.
They're mean. They're three mean movies. This movie is mean top to bottom. A lot of the stuff in 50 First Dates is also like mean.
Rob Schneider's entire character and the ways in which he like hates his wife is like some of the most upsetting shit in that movie.
Yeah, like it's just mean. And then like freaking the mean machine that is The Longest Yard, man. Like, it's just it's abuse of power and all this. Like, they're three very mean movies that just do not jive at all with what the other films in this. And I understand him working with Peter Siegel. I imagine that, like, it has to do with the fact that Chris Farley had worked with him for something like Tommy Boy, and maybe it's fulfilling, like, the agreement that Chris had with him to do other films or something
they're all three successful movies, too, though, right? Yes. Like, let's not beat around the bush. As much as we could say, like, we don't like these movies now in retrospect, they did what they were supposed to do for this three-movie run that they did together.
So then why isn't there a fourth movie? That's the question.
Because this was something that we've seen with Sandler before. He likes working with people for short stints. There's not really a director of his that we've hit that they've done more than three movies together.
True. That's true. Tim Hurley, he has a really great moment at the end of the My Buddy Jack, where he's like, man, me and Adam used to be best friends. I remember that. And it's just like, oh, Tim Hurley, you poor bastard. You're still an executive producer on this, so I don't feel too bad.
Yeah, but I mean, like, look at somebody like Tim Hurley, who he's like, yeah, I'm not, you don't direct my movies anymore, but you still get to be in on all of this with us. Yeah. Like,
or okay. Steve Brill and the other one, Roberto Corsi. I can't think of his first name, but I'm Roberto, your daddy. it's that character. Yeah, it's I don't know. Peter Karachi, I don't know. I get Frank Karachi. I knew I would get there. I do an Adam Sandler podcast, you know. So these, and it's very strange to me because I remember one of the earliest theses that I put out there was maybe the Drew Barrymore stuff winds up in its own parallel dimension. But these three films, the Peter Siegel trilogy, really just is a pocket dimension all its own in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And I think that's the best way that I could describe it. Right? Because it's fringe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because it's like, the other thing is that, like, looking at all three of them, like, right next to each other, they all have a feminine presenting male character, right? All of them use that trope. Like, and I know we see it in other things, but like the way that they're treated in these three movies is just not good.
Yeah.
It's like 50 First Dates would be the closest one. Cause like there's the most amount of Sandler injected into that one, but I don't know. Rudy freaking Giuliani's in this movie doing the You Can Do It thing. And, like, hindsight on Rudy Giuliani and what we know about him now, but, like...
Yeah, right.
Oh, I don't know. This was not an easy watch. And I hate anger management. But I will say this. My hatred of anger management did not interfere with my approaching this film and trying to look at it academically and do it. And it just doesn't check enough boxes to be in there. Yeah. And if that doesn't fit, and if 50 First Dates doesn't fit... And so much of the DNA is the same between that and Longest Yard, then Peter Siegel just does not jive with what our Adam Sandler cinematic universe means.
So I can have said it better, man. Yeah.
All right, so this has been our Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe exploration into anger management. And next month, oh good, we don't have it. What are we doing next month, Sijin? You get to decide right now. No, I'm pretty sure I know what it is.
Are we doing the ASCU revisit?
No, we're not doing the ASCU revisit yet. Okay. No, it's ripe for it. I'm excited to do it, especially by the end of this month. Murder Mystery 2 is going to be out there. Very excited for that. Coming March 31st, if you haven't heard the news yet, Murder Mystery 2 will be coming to Netflix. No, what we're doing in April, because why not, right? April seems a fine enough month to do it. We're doing Coneheads.
Oh, man. Okay, which is a revamp, redo, remake, if you will, of an SNL, a long-running SNL series.
Yeah. And it definitely peppers into other stuff that we've seen in the ASCU, other actors that Adam has worked with. So it's going to be an interesting one because he's in it. I know that he's in it. I don't remember how he's in it, but I do know that he's in it.
To my memory, he has about the level of character that Dan Aykroyd usually gets in one of his movies. So it's a good flip.
It might be a grain of Sandler, but it is definitely a reboot, remake, redo of something that came before. And it might be the only SNL movie that Adam Sandler's ever been a part of, right?
Don't hold us to that one. We haven't done our research yet.
Yeah, don't hold us to that one. I think it might be, though. Like off the top of my head, because it's not long after that he does Billy. I'm going to call the shot. You know what? Frick it. We did something crazy last month with making you hold off to find that. Here it is definitively. The Longest Yard and Anger Management, they are not in our Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I did want to make sure I said that. And next month, for April, we're doing Coneheads. And I'm excited to do Coneheads. I honestly am very excited to do Coneheads.
Yeah, I'm gonna get some toilet paper to chomp down on and enjoy the movie, I think.
Is that the one where the guy chews on condoms like gum? I guess I'll do that, right? Since you're going to be eating all the TP. It's expensive now, though. Have you seen the prices of eggs and TP? We used to throw that stuff on houses. Now it's gold, Sijin. All right, yeah. So that's it. This has been the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. If you enjoyed us doing this, this comes out every month, usually like the second Friday of every month, as close to the 9th as we can make it happen, because the 9th is always for Adam Sandler, at least in my life. I can't speak for Sijin, but I feel like that's the case. But if you've enjoyed us focusing on one very specific topic with the ASCU, you can always join us on our other podcast, The Say Report. That drops every Monday, and that's a show about everything. We did a lot in New Old Borrowed Blue because I wanted to inject the fact that we're going to be looking at my boss's daughter, which I'm kind of excited about, and because there's so much more that we didn't discuss in this episode. So come find us over there. If you have anything to say specifically to the show or Sijin, the best way to reach us is at TheASCU on Twitter. Make sure that, because Sijin got off Twitter a long time ago. Me, I'm staying on. I'm gonna play till the boat goes down.
Yeah. And if you want to see his frequent updates on the Anger Management TV show, I'm sure that you can find a few things from him at Devin D. Decker.
Yes, I'm watching it for a reason. What reason that is right now, I'm not quite sure. Enjoyment, I guess. Can we just watch things for enjoyment anymore? That's a topic for discussion on the Say Report. But right now, this is us saying goodbye to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, closing our book until next month. And remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at TheASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.